Okay, here's week two, bonus chapter. There's a little bit of thinking about power sources that I thought would be really useful before we get into the Industrial Revolution. And also, I just have some weird stuff to show you. This is not academic, this is not scholarly, this is not supported by research. Most of my pictures are not even captioned. I threw this together fast with some stuff I had lying around because I think the pictures tell the story. So this is just fast and informative and fun. Some stuff to think about. In our world today, we do not think about where our power comes from. We think about power all the time. Your iPhone died, your battery died, you have to plug it in, and you'll do almost anything to get plugged in. You'll sit outside next to an outlet in the cold because your battery's dying. But we don't think about what's used to produce that energy. It's just part of what we do. It's like breathing. And that's a really recent sort of blindness. Our unawareness of power is very recent. In most parts of the United States, electric power is only about 80 years old, less old in some places. It took a massive national effort to electrify this country and get electricity distributed to the more remote parts of the country, to farmland. We think of electricity as something that's ubiquitous, it's everywhere, it's available, but that's only been true for a little while. Today we think of steam power as an old technology, a Victorian sort of thing, but it's in use everywhere in our world. We use steam power to generate that electricity that we so take for granted. And that advance to steam power laid the groundwork for all of our dependence on electricity, on power. We're going to look more at that next week. The basic premise is you boil water, it expands when it turns to steam, and you use that expansion in volume to turn something. Steam power fits into a category I would call harnessing nature to get power. But it's a little bit different from other sources because we're augmenting or changing the state of nature to produce power. We're boiling the water. We're adding heat to change its volume and then harness that volume change. But there are lots of other ways we harness nature for power in today's world, but in ancient ways as well. Windmills are familiar to many of us because they're reappearing on our landscape as modern technology. It's very old technology, and windmills have been seen around the world for a very long time. The Nashtifan windmill is a wonderful surviving relic of a really ancient type of windmill, and it's a completely different format, different axis, different rotational model than the windmills that I have in my mind when I imagine a windmill, and such a beautiful thing. There are also examples of water mills, water wheels, all over the world. They're essentially the same. There's not a lot of variety. It's a big wheel with paddles that capture the water. The water can fall over them, an overshot wheel. It can flow under them and be an undershot wheel. But the basic premise is that moving water turns a wheel, and that movement does something. In most of the world, what that movement did was move the water into a field for agricultural purposes. But there are many examples also of the water wheel motion powering some piece of machinery to grind grain, to do something in a factory. And there are examples from all over the world throughout time. I don't want to talk too much about the Marly machine in France because my students are researching it this semester, and I don't want to make that any easier for them. But I have to include it here because it's one of the most staggeringly confusing and wonderful examples of water power. It also led to many, many innovations in how we use power later in other methods of creating power. It was finished in 1684, and it took 3 years to build, and it cost, in today's dollars, about $120 million. Very expensive to build. It was called at the time the eighth wonder of the world, and it was built to do a very tiny little thing in my brain, but a huge thing in someone else's brain. The King of France wanted fountains with water at Versailles, at his palace, but the Seine was 5 miles away. So the Marly machine used the movement of the river to power the wheels that powered pumps that pumped river water uphill into an aqueduct that flowed 5 miles to the fountains of Versailles. The things you can do with money, right? It was 14 gigantic wooden water wheels, each one almost 40 feet across. And it used over 250 pumps to get water about 500 feet uphill into the aqueduct. Really remarkable engineering accomplishment for its day or ever. That's all I want to include right now about that. It's the most extreme example I could show you of harnessing nature's power to do something for us. And I think it is most impressive because I think it's most ridiculous. I want to shift into looking at other things that could turn a wheel that aren't a natural resource. How could we turn a wheel without wind or water? There are many options. An obvious one would be do it ourselves, human power. This is a sort of confusing example, but if I didn't include it, somebody would tell me I should have. This is from Conan the Barbarian. Arnold Schwarzenegger, as a small child, is captured and enslaved and strapped to this machine, and he grows up and turns into Conan by pushing it around endlessly. This is frustrating to me because that machine doesn't actually do anything that we're told about. It just is there to punish people. There is a relationship between human power and punishment. Of course, throughout time, we have enslaved other people to provide power for ourselves, or we have been enslaved by other people to provide them power. So this is fiction, this movie, right? There's nothing realistic about this. But the idea of using enslaved people to push a mechanism is not fiction. We've already looked in this class at the Archimedes screw, the screw that lives inside a cylinder, so it has one internal chamber that rotates water uphill. And the examples I showed you were human-powered, rotational with a crank, rotational by walking on them, and those were used by many cultures throughout time around the world. There are other ways to do something similar, to move water uphill for irrigation, for farming. There are a lot of examples in Asia of foot-powered, not screw-oriented pumps, but chamber-oriented pumps using a piece of bamboo or a tubing. People walk on a shaft that turns the internal lifting component. We also looked at Lambert Hitchcock's treadle-powered lathe, which is powered by foot. You press over and over again. That treadle was an interesting advance. Instead of having to mimic walking on something that was rotational, this is up and down motion that's transferred to rotation with a mechanism. There are lots of foot-operated machines used all the way up through the 1920s and 30s. As we were electrifying rural areas, those rural areas were still finding other ways to power things. So even with what I think of as relatively modern machines, jigsaws, scroll saws, there are examples of treadle-powered versions. The most famous treadle-powered machine, of course, is the sewing machine. The majority of early sewing machines graduated from being hand-cranked, which is really impractical if you're trying to also sew, hold things in place, to foot-powered with a treadle, which was a really practical way to do that. You're sitting down to sew anyway. There are still places where treadle-powered sewing machines are used. One, because electricity isn't available. Two, because electricity is expensive. Three, because the equipment lasted so long it's still in use. A lot more of our world relied on human power in the past. Not just for personal power, like to run my sewing machine, but for communal power, to do stuff for industry. And that's where a treadmill comes into this story. A treadmill is something that turns and is walked upon. You tread on it. On the left is an angled treadmill, so the person walking just walks straight and the disc spins around underneath him. On the right is a rotational treadmill, the people get inside. On the right, you'll notice the people are chained. They are slaves working in a salt mine in medieval Italy, and that salt mine lasted for centuries. The mining of salt was a huge industry in our world for centuries, and the labor it took to mine that salt is a big part of this early power story. Obviously, this is not a fun job. You think it would be fun to get inside a big treadmill, or in this case, to stand outside it and use your feet to turn it from the outside, and it would be fun for 5 minutes. But if this was your job all day long, it would tip into punishment, right? And it was usually the marginalized who were willing to take these jobs, or the enslaved who were forced to take them. There's a clear path also from this labor to punishment. You can understand why the use of criminals in prisons would be applied to treadmill power. There's a long history of treadmills in prisons. The first recorded mechanical advance in this was introduced by William Cubitt, an English engineer who dreamed up the treadmill that used prisoners to grind corn. His treadmill was put in use in 1818, and it fit 24 prisoners. And they would work the length of this 24-person treadmill. They'd move down it and then get off. So there's a constant supply of new prisoners getting on. That gave them rest time, but it can't have been a nice experience. The most famous example of the toll a prison treadmill took on a person's body would be Oscar Wilde. He was imprisoned in 1895 and sentenced to hard labor. He worked a treadmill, he fell off a number of times, struck his head. It almost killed him in prison, but then it certainly contributed to his death only 2 years after he got out of prison. So this was really hard work. At first, prison treadmills were attached to a machine to grind corn, to grind grain. But eventually, they were decoupled from any equipment, and it was just a treadmill for punishment. There's a really long history of this idea of human-powered equipment. All of the medieval castles that were built with huge stones lifted way up high were created with the use of rotational human-powered cranes. So workers would walk up to the top, usually two at a time, get in the treadmill, and the turning of that treadmill would lift stones up for construction. It's a pretty rudimentary system. It's a rotational cage, essentially, and the axle of that cage winds the rope, the lifting rope, around it. So there's no reducing gear, there's no ratio change. It lifted that stone slowly. So there's lots and lots of walking for every stone lifted up. I'm only showing you images of rotational human-powered cranes from medieval Europe, because that's what I could find, but I believe this technology was used around the world. On the bottom is an example of a rotational crane being used in France today to build a medieval castle in our world. And on the right is a surviving wheel-powered crane in Gdansk, in what is now Poland, that was used not to build castles, not to lift stones up, but to remove cargo from ships. So it's right out on the water. If you think about how many centuries we were walking to power our world, it becomes even more ridiculous and, to me, kind of unfathomable to think that what we do now is use electricity to power a machine on which we can row or walk or run so that we lose weight and stay active. Like, what's wrong with us? It would be natural to try and look for replacements for human power. And of course, what we turned to was animals. As we domesticated more and more animals, we found lots of ways to use them. So of course, we know that we used horses, donkeys, camels, elephants to transport stuff for us. There are many accounts of that. But we also started attaching animals to wheels to get stuff places for us. This is my favorite example, Josephine Baker driving around with her ostrich power. The animals most frequently used for rotational power were oxen and donkeys because of their strength. Donkeys were used in wheels because they were small enough to get in and out. So oxen were used outdoors. I've chosen to show you the donkey because I know it's cruel, but don't you want a donkey in a wheel just walking around powering your stuff? Of course you do. This was a common power source for, on the left, lifting water out of a well. This castle had an extremely deep well, and so the rotational wheel lifted the water up from the well. And on the right, rotation by walking around in circles that runs one stone against another to grind grain. One of the main reasons we domesticated horses was to use for transportation, to attach them to wheels, a chariot, a wagon. And we did that in Egypt and Rome and China and everywhere. Horses pulled stuff for us. At first, we also used them to pull farming equipment. There's a long tradition of plows and threshers and eventually combines being pulled by horses. That makes sense. Horse pulls a piece of equipment that's on wheels through the field. We also realized you could have multiple horses walking around in circles to power machinery in the field to do other kinds of work. But there are some other uses of horses that we have chosen to forget. Salt mining, as I mentioned, was a really big part of the sort of economic fuel and subsistence of our world. We used it for curing meat, we used it for preserving foods, we used it for flavoring things. There were a lot of uses for salt. The most famous ancient salt mine is in Poland, and it has over 1 million tourists a year who go there to see it because there are complete underground rooms carved out of the salt. The most famous of them is a chapel where the workers could go to mass because the goal was to leave everyone down there as much as possible. It took a lot of energy to get people up and down. It took even more energy to get a horse up and down. And this salt mine was powered by horses. There were up to 100 horses below powering all of the mining equipment. And so they did not come back up to the surface. Horses were lowered down and spent their entire lives in the mine. That was the power source. They were well cared for, but can you imagine being a horse and never seeing daylight? Just living down in a mine, walking around all day long to power the mining equipment. I went combing through Diderot's encyclopedia for evidence of horse power or any animal power, and I found a number of examples of horses being shown powering equipment. The image on the left is making cardboard. The image on the right is refining sugar. The sugar one is easy to see. The horses walk around doing the grinding. The cardboard making is a little harder to see. Way in the background is a horse powering a piece of equipment, and it also looks, unfortunately, like that horse is being whipped. We've used horses in some other interesting ways. Horses were a common power source for ferries, boat power. Sometimes the horse was on what we think of as a treadmill, a strip that rotated. So the horse stayed in one place walking, and that rotation powered the paddle wheels on the side of the ferry. But sometimes the horse was walking on a flat rotational disc. So it walked in one place, and that disc turned below it. That allowed multiple horses. This is called the whim style. I don't know why. I don't know the origin of that word. I'm sorry. I should have looked it up. But this was like a ferryman's dream, because with a whim style horsepower situation, you could have up to three horses at once, and that gave you three horsepower, and that allowed a ferry to go 6 miles an hour, so you could get across a river faster with more horsepower. We've even made horsepower as a mobile unit, a treadmill for a horse that you could wheel anywhere you need to hook it up to a machine. So when we started ginning our cotton, separating our cotton with a machine, that got scaled up with a power source, and you'd want to wheel the treadmill to the place you were going to use the horse and use it right there. It's a funny idea, isn't it, to take this animal that's designed for motion to move and then make it stationary somewhere, generating movement in a field. And there are many other examples of horse movement being attached to equipment, especially farming equipment, to use their motion to create power. In my brain, maybe in yours also, I think of trains as something uniquely linked to steam power. We invented steam power, we invented the train. In fact, trains existed long before steam power. They just were pulled by horses. Tracks allowed more things to be pulled with less energy than over a bumpy road. So the idea of a track with a carriage or a series of containers being pulled by people, by horses, was especially prevalent in mining, but also in transportation. And even after we got steam power, we were still using horses. These are examples of farm equipment that is steam powered. It's a steam powered combine, but it would be dragged out into the field and moved around by a team of horses. So even though the steam engine had the ability to produce rotational movement, because it was being attached to farming equipment, it couldn't also work for locomotion. I need to point out that I think you already get where the term horsepower comes from. The carriage on the top has one horse, so it's a one horsepower vehicle. The vehicle on the bottom is a three horsepower vehicle because there are three horses attached to it. When we started to make engines that worked in different ways, we communicated their power by using the horse equivalent. The world understood what horsepower meant based on one horse, two horse. So it was an obvious equation to employ when talking about a motor that didn't use a natural power source. We have completely forgotten that. So now we only think of horsepower as what's under the hood in a car. It is still that same equation. It relates back to the equivalent amount of energy you could get from a horse. The De Chevaux, one of the most famous cars ever made, has Chevaux in the name because that's horse. For any of my students here in Providence or anyone who knows Providence, Rhode Island, this is an image that should seem sort of familiar. In the background is the Baptist Church on Main Street, and in the foreground is the Gorham Manufacturing Company. Those buildings are not there anymore, but the building that replaced them is part of our school campus. Gorham converted to steam pretty early, but before that, they powered their factory with a horse. So somewhere in this complex of buildings was a horse room where a horse walked around in a circle and powered the equipment in that factory. And every time I walk past the grass garden along the river, I say hello to old Dick, who I imagine in some spirit world is still in there walking in circles all day long. But brace yourself, because the story's going to get a little bit weird here. For centuries, cooking meat was really difficult to accomplish. You couldn't use your convection oven to make sure it stayed succulent and moist while being beautifully crisp on the outside. Can you tell I've been watching MasterChef? For centuries, we cooked meat over an open fire. And that required a lot of effort, because if you just park the meat over the fire, you'll burn it on the bottom and leave it raw on top. You need to rotate that meat constantly, slowly, for the entire cooking period so that you get it cooked evenly and you don't dry it out too much in one place. That effort of rotating the spit was a major focus of household labor. It was a job usually given to children because what else are you going to do with them? We didn't have school to go to. So stand there and turn this spit for the next 4 hours. Unfortunately, standing that close to the fire also led to lots of problems. It was extremely hot. So often there was a wet bale of hay between the fire and the worker to diffuse that heat while they turned the spit for hours and hours. It's pretty easy to understand why people were casting about for a better method of rotating meat than this. And I know this seems like a tiny little funny detail, but for me, that's the beauty of object history. So much of our life involved eating. The equipment we used to prepare that food really made a difference in how we lived our daily lives. Eventually, we figured out a mechanical solution. Use clockworks, wound springs, weights as pulleys to turn gears to create steady, regular motion. So you just have to walk by and wind it up or reset the weights, and it will turn automatically until your food is cooked. That was the birth of something we called the spit jack, a mechanical jack that rotates the spit. And there are lots of kinds. There are ones that are mounted on the wall with weights, like a cuckoo clock. There are rotational ones. There are some that were built into the chimney that used the escaping smoke to turn, so using a kind of wind power. But before we figured out the mechanism, which was quite complicated, right? It wasn't until 1795 that the first mechanical spit jack appeared, because we needed to understand clockmaking and gear making and all of the other things involved in making these compact, complicated mechanisms. So for centuries until we figured that out, after child cranking behind a wet bale of hay, before automatic mechanism, there was a long chapter of another power source. The turnspit dog. And I feel like I need to pause for a moment so you can gasp or catch your breath or laugh or wonder why I didn't offer a trigger warning before showing you an image of a stuffed dog, which comes from a Victorian museum in England and is the only picture, photographic picture of a turnspit dog I've ever seen. It seems like a ridiculous thing, but in Tudor England, this was the best way to get your meat cooked without having to turn the crank yourself. The dog was bred to be small, to fit inside the rotational cage, to be long so that its feet were far apart and could maximize motion, to have a flexible spine, right? Everything about the shape of this dog was bred and created so that the dog could run inside a cage for as long as possible. You won't like hearing this, but the way people would keep the dog running all day was not offering a little chewy bone, but throwing hot coals in behind it. So to get away from the coal, the dog would run. We're not good human beings. I mean, we might be doing our best, but it's not always great. So anyway, we got our meat cooked. Also, on their day off, on Sunday, church day, they were taken to church and used as foot warmers because churches weren't heated at the time. So the life of the turnspit was quite rough. It led very directly in 1850 to the founding of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. So we don't have turnspit dogs anymore. The breed has disappeared because the work we created them for has disappeared. But their shadow is cast in our world today because they were part of helping us realize that we should be kinder, not only to each other, but perhaps to lesser creatures also. In case you think that using dogs for power stopped in Victorian England, you're wrong. Nicholas Potter patented something he called the Enterprise Dog Power. It was a treadmill in 1881, and it was designed to attach to a butter churn. Making butter involves a lot of effort. And there are lots of examples throughout history of people trying to figure out ways to have less effort involved. This is one example. And it was patented, it was manufactured, it was sold. It led to other versions by other manufacturers. There was one for sale in Sears catalog for $4.50. And the instructions pointed out that if you didn't have a large breed dog, you could also use a goat or a sheep. I could go on forever with this. There are so many great examples of how we've exploited living creatures. Ourselves, human beings, animals, four legs, two legs, whatever, to do stuff for us. But I'm gonna stop, because let's be reasonable, and just give you the takeaway, which is to ask you to think about how things used to be powered before we got so much cheap and available power that we just totally stopped even thinking about it. I believe that in order to appreciate the Industrial Revolution and what steam power did, we actually need to be able to appreciate power. And in our world in 2020, it's one of the many things that we've stopped even noticing. So that's all. Just crack your brain open, plop that one idea in, seal it back up, and I'll see you next time. Something's gone wrong with my... No. No. I can't advance the slide. Come on. Why? Where did you go? And we put the tape over this, and we carefully put it in the pocket so nothing changes. And, okay.